I did mention to those of you who were here last week a preview of what I was going to be talking about or trying to address. There's a timely and an important conversation that needs to happen and needs to happen well, graciously, truthfully, forthrightly, lovingly. A conversation we were anticipating between people of faith or call themselves believers and those who might call themselves atheists or practitioners of no faith. And it is a delicate matter. It is an important one, but one that needs to be entered into with deliberation, with grace and prayer, and charitable disposition. I recognize that even in this congregation, that we belong to a spectrum of belief or perhaps even unbelief. And we reiterate week after week that all are welcome here. We remind ourselves that God's grace and love and depth is wide enough and broad enough to accommodate us as we are. But we also contend that that is purposed to move us beyond where we are now. And so that is my hope and prayer for our time of reflection. I have prayed and struggled over this week and asked that the Spirit be with us as we engage this particular undertaking. Let me begin by saying that the question that occurred to me as I reflected on this Psalm 14, hence the title, Both Fool and Seeker, is in what ways might we be practitioners of both these dispositions? The Psalm seems to recognize that the world is not divided into evildoers and good doers, as it were, but that the line between those two seems to course its way through the very center of our heart and our lives, all people. So we are, in some senses, practitioners of both of these, seeking after God, seeking after something ultimate, something deeper, and acting in ways as if God doesn't care about what goes on here, and there's no reckoning. Sometimes referred to as practical atheism. There are people who would call themselves believers, but live and act in a way that, for all intents and purposes, show no regard or very little regard for the existence and the agency and the activity of God. So the mouths and the behavior don't cohere. So I want us to explore that a little bit. And I wanted to say at the outset that in a sense we're in this together. This is not a case of trying to put up atheistic straw people to cut down and chop down and point out how silly they are. It is for us to be honest in engaging what this business of faith or unfaith and pursuit is. As I mentioned, Psalm 14 is a lament. And in some, it's a lament of all those who have gone astray, all of us. It is a lament of the consequences of a belief system that does not take seriously the consequences of doing wrong and believes there is no reckoning at the end. In this way, it's similar to Psalm 10 that says, "He will not avenge," speaking of God, "for there is no God." It is a lament of a particular oppression and suffering of the poor and those who are vulnerable, the exploitation of them because of a consequence of this ignoring the accountable relationship and requirements of God. And it is a timely lament, that I believe is enduring for all seasons of human living. But let's explore a little bit about what it means and what it does not mean and what is it saying before we move more deeply into our conversation. What is this psalm about? The word that stands out in the psalm is the word that is translated fool. Now, the English word fool is used to translate or accommodate a variety of Hebrew words, and it's important to know which one is being referred to so we can have a deeper understanding of the sense of the psalm. There are four groupings of fools, if I can put it that way, according to the Hebrew. The first, pithia in Hebrew, is a kind of an airhead, gullible person. So it makes reference to those who just kind of are easily taken in. Then there's what's called a kechiel, who is a self-confident fool. And this particular foolish person is stubborn, mouthy, thinks it's fun to cause trouble. Now, we don't know anybody like that. And then there is the evil in Hebrew. And the evil is a committed fool. This is a fool of a completely different order. Morally perverse, insolent, committed to rebellious ideas and destructive behavior. In fact, there's a separate category in this particular, the subcategory of evils called the Nabal. One who takes this to an even higher extent is boorish, rude, vile, arrogant. This is the word, the evil in Hebrew, that is used in Psalm 14. But there's another kind of fool of which the Hebrew language refers in the Bible. The lutz. And the lutz is the scornful fool, contemptuous, mocks spiritual truth. Anything good is an evangelist for folly and foolishness. So you see, when we are describing categories, as it were, it's important to know what is being referred to. And so if we thought that what we encounter today in the variety of human ways of living and acting is anything new, this was already experienced and anticipated in Scripture and beyond. It suggests that there is, within the human community, a spectrum of ways of being that has always been. It is just, it takes new and more contextual forms in our present reality. Atheism, but before getting there, let me say this, so that you see the connection. What is being spoken of here in this particular psalm, Psalm 14, when it says, a fool says in his heart, or their heart, there is no God, it is not expressly speaking of atheism. It is rather speaking of one who does not care or does not believe that God has any business to do with human living. Therefore, there is no consequence for any actions that I take. I can oppress the poor, I can be evil, I can do all kinds of things. This God does not care and is not involved. So it's not atheism per se, because frankly, the biblical worldview in the ancient times did not even conceive of the possibility of there being no God. There's a competition of gods, but the notion that there is no God is foreign to the biblical worldview, per se. Atheism, as we understand it today in its modern way, actually finds its roots in classical times. In the Greek myths and mythologies, you read philosophers begin to raise the possibility that something more or different needs to obtain than what they witness in the petty, capricious, ludicrous, jealous, violent activity and behavior of the gods of Mount Olympus. In fact, if you read Homer's Iliad, you begin to recognize that here it is the pettiness of the gods that is illumined along with other things. The real growth of atheism, as we have now come to be experiencing it, actually started in the 18th century and found its structural expression in the French Revolution, 1789. And what happened is that it was understood and seen that the church was more concerned about its status and its power than the plight of the people, especially the poor. And in this instance, it has departed from its original mandate when that is the case. And so what grew up was a movement, a grassroots movement, a philosophical movement buttressed by particular activity and activism that said what we need to do is to do away with this God that this church represents, put in its place an atheism, and this will be liberated. The mantra was religion is oppressor, atheism is liberator. It's very interesting that in 2005, when we took a group of people from Parkdale here, we went to Cuba to work on an organic farm and to meet the Christians. We had conversations with representatives from different parts of society. And I remember in a conversation with a representative of the Cuban government and a theologian at the seminary there, that the same situation occurred, that the Cuban Revolution, as it were, was a protest against the insensitivity and, in fact, the more than insensitivity, the utter disregard of much of the church of that time towards the poor and towards those who were struggling. And what rose up was a popular movement seeking to displace that disregard, that institutionalized disregard, and replace it with a more caring understanding and structure. So it has repeated itself, as it were. So atheism, in a sense, grew up in response or in reaction to what was perceived as the constricting, uncaring, violent presence of the religious community. But then we have to ask, as we look historically, before we come to reflect on some of the philosophical underpinnings, we have to ask, what happened when atheism took over? What happened when the displacement of the church and its ideology and its practice was replaced by atheism and a new ideology and a new practice? Well, again, history is very disclosive. For 1917 and the Russian Revolution, we now see what happened over those years and those decades. This supposed savior of atheism actually turned out to be as brutal or even more as that which the church is accused of in the Spanish Inquisition, in all of the ways in which it terrorized scientists and so forth. We realize that what is being disclosed is the capacity of human nature to take whatever that human believes in and to carry it to an extreme that moves in ways that are injurious to the human community. I think it is very interesting that you look at Stalin's atrocities and the death squads. You look at the massacre of Mongolian Buddhist monks by a so-called atheistic liberating philosophy, and you begin to realize that there is no salvation there. You look at the regime of Pol Pot, who was not a religious person, that defied anything, any kind of notion, if you will, that there was any recompense or reconciling, and the massacre of millions of people in Cambodia. That's not a religious undertaking. So we have to be careful when we, in broad strokes, begin to say that religion equals violence and extremism and oppression, and atheism equals liberation and the freeing of constraints for people to be how they want to be. That is just not true historically. I refer you, and I don't have time to go into all the things, but you could Google and look up what's called the Black Book of Communism that documents the abuses. And it is very interesting that after the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the erosion of the Russian Revolution experiment and the attempt to suppress the Orthodox Church and the Christians, that there has been a resurgence in the Orthodox Church and faith. In fact, the leaders, the newer leaders of the social wing, if you will, of the government, the communist government, has sought out the wisdom and the leadership of the patriarch and the Orthodox priest in order to restore some order to society and to return to something of a common commitment to morality. That's an interesting turn of events. I want to share with you One of the writers that I love to read and engage with, both philosophically and it blends my commitment to theology and interest in quantum physics. This particle physicist, John Pocklinghorn, who's also an Anglican priest, he writes this, and I want to share a little bit at length some of his perceptions. Whatever it is that we do in life, the experiences we have will color our thoughts and mold our ways of thinking. I have spent 30 years of my life working as a theoretical physicist, trying to use mathematics to understand some of the beautiful patterns and order of the physical world, for good or ill. And no doubt it is a mixture of both. This affects how I think about all sorts of things. The way I like to characterize my habits of thought is to say that I am a bottom-up thinker. Bottom-up thinking is natural for a scientist for two reasons. One, it is that we are looking for ideas that have reasons backing them up. These reasons will lie in the evidence we consider, the events that motivate our belief. The second point is that we have learned that the world is full of surprises. That means it is very hard to guess beforehand what the right general ideas will turn out to be. Only experience can tell us that. He uses an example. In quantum mechanics, all this changes when you get down to what they are doing. Take an electron, one of the constituents of the atom. If you know where it is, you cannot know where it is going. If you know what it is doing, you cannot know where it is. This is called the Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. The quantum world is fuzzy and unpicturable. We cannot imagine in everyday terms what it is like. Nevertheless, we can understand it using mathematics and a special set of quantum ideas which we have learned about from a bottom-up approach. Now, the physical world is so full of surprises, it would be strange if God didn't also exceed our expectations in quite unexpected ways. Common sense thinking by itself won't be adequate to tell us what God is like. We'll have to try and find out how God has actually made God's self known. That is why I was keen in the preceding section to think of the Bible as a source of evidence about how God has acted in history and above all in Jesus Christ. It's a natural strategy for a bottom-up thinker to pursue. Very interesting reflection about the surprises in the so-called scientific world, because that is one of the reasons that is put forward for the, the passé reality of religion. Science now has replaced, so it goes, the need for religion. And it shows by evidentiary protocols that there is no need for God. In fact, there is no God. Except when one presses these, you find a discussion taking place among scientists that this is overreaching the extent and the capacity of science. The truth is that science cannot investigate certain aspects of the reality of human life. And if that is so, that means then that it cannot be the all-exhaustive construct that is used to determine faith or not. For example, science is based fundamentally on the ability to construct hypotheses and theories on repeatable evidentiary protocols. In other words, you have to have something that you can show over and over again, repeatedly, will come out the same way as evidenced by a hypothesis. If you use that standard for scientists, which is a broadly accepted one, then science cannot investigate history. Because history, moving linearly, is unrepeatable. You cannot go back and say, let's experiment and see if the French Revolution took place, if Napoleon's campaigns took place. It cannot investigate on strict scientific method. Other roles or vistas, if you will, of human inquiry is needed. Similarly, science cannot investigate the responses that take place in how we conceive beauty. Scientific theory cannot fundamentally describe what happens, the totality of what happens between two people who are in love. Evolutionary biology and evidentiary protocols, again, can talk about some of the synaptic activity that takes place in the parts of the brain relative to the kinds of emotion and commitments that are made. It cannot, however, go beyond that to describe that which is between human relationship and the expression of love that cannot be reduced to science. We also accept that science, as it were, although it claims to be the authors that are writing on this, like Sam Harris, Dennett, Christopher Hitchens, Dawkins, that talk about the fact that science has shown not only that God is an impossibility, but also that what we need to do is to base all of our decisions on rational thought. Now, faith has never said that the role of reason is to be absent from the inquiry. All it says, it is only one form of inquiry. I want to share again a testimony through his own words, Alistair McGrath, a scientist who used to be an atheist. And these are the reasons he gives for no longer being an atheist. My doubts about the intellectual foundations of atheism began to coalesce into a realization that atheism was itself a belief system, whereas I had assumed it to be a factual statement about reality. I also discovered that I knew far less about Christianity than I had assumed. As I began to read Christian books, listen to Christian friends, explain what they actually believed, it gradually became clear to me that what I had rejected was merely a religious stereotype. I had some major rethinking to do. After checking out Christianity's credentials and discovering its immense spiritual vitality and intellectual potency, I came to faith in the God whom I had once regarded as little more than an obsolete curiosity. So in the end, I turned my back on one faith and embraced another. Although I am no longer an atheist, I retain my respect for atheism and continue to be interested in it as a major belief system that deserves careful, respectful, yet critical attention. Now, it's a very interesting statement by a scientist come religious person or Christian, because what Sam Harris and Daniel Dennett and Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, and a special word about Christopher Hitchens does not call himself an atheist. He rather calls himself an anti-theist. Because in his book, God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything, his contention is that faith is not only a neutral reality that some may choose or not, but it is behind the poisoning and the undermining of everything good in humanity. Therefore, in fact, what we're doing today, Christopher Hitchens would say, is in a way an act of abuse. To teach children the way of faith and the way of God and God's love and about Jesus is a form of child abuse, he writes. So it is more than atheism, it is a belief system that he calls anti-theism. The point that Alistair McGrath makes is an important one, because oftentimes in my dialogue with atheists would say to me, we're talking about science versus belief, fact versus spiritual inquiry. And the fact of the matter is that as human beings, again, as science points out, we cannot hold to any ideological position without an act of faith. Science itself is predicated on the use of faith, small f faith, in order to compose hypotheses. Hypotheses are the best guesses about what takes place. You don't know for sure. You're guessing and you trust that guess until you can prove it. So the fact of the matter is not, we're not talking about hard evidence versus belief. We are, as Alistair says, talking about two belief systems. If that is true, then let's understand the origins of those belief systems, the impact they have not only on the person who holds them, but also on the rest of the world, should everyone be commended to respond in that way. We have already outlined that potential for abuse exists in both of these realms. But at its core and at its heart, what is it that we are meant to be engaged in? I believe, and here's where I think the Christian community and people of faith need to take a sober look in the mirror and to recognize that we act in ways that promote and even foster atheism. The reason being, I believe, is that our practice of love is imperfect and sometimes manipulative and capricious. Our practice of justice sometimes self-serving, selfish, and so forth. The ideals that we have, the way in which we often, or too often how we practice it, cause others to say, well, if that's supposed to be God's representative, I want no part of it. And we have to take responsibility for that and say that those accusations are true. Not trying to deny them, we put beside that also that you cannot be so selective in your regard of the activity of the Christian community. We also have to recognize that the long history of the Christian church and its initiatives have also profoundly blessed the world. You've heard me over and over recount how from the very early days of Jesus' life, the disciples and those communities gathered under the way of Jesus, the way they followed and the way they loved, transform communities and villages. Even in the Roman Empire, it was recognized that that which the Christians practiced, the Roman Empire had no hope of even approaching in its magnitude, in its generosity, in its constancy. The whole public education system has come about because of the church. Before, it was reserved for very private and select people of power and money. The emergence of the asylum, a place that would take care and help those who are mentally ill, came from the church because of the way they were abused and put aside and treated. There are public institutions and things today we take for granted that are the genesis, if you will, of the commitment of those who have formed their lives by the way of God after the example of Jesus that bless and bequeath to the world. That is without doubt. Now, in preparation for this, I think it's important for me to share with you. I wanted and I asked specifically for some help. And so I asked people to write to me and talk to me in interview about why they are atheists or why they have trouble with faith. And I think it's important to hear those things, and I'll just share a few of those. One shared a distrust in human nature, a strong belief that humans are flawed animals and instinctually religious and have a tendency to anthropomorphize the universe. There's a wealth of evolutionary psychology literature that articulately explains case after case our flawed instincts. And I would say to that, I agree. And in fact, the Bible agrees that this is what the Bible calls sin, as it were, that which separates us from God and from each other. Culture. I do not identify culturally as a religious person, just as a Christian might have difficulty becoming a Muslim or a Buddhist becoming Jewish. I, as an atheist, have a great deal of emotional resistance to becoming religious. I hear that and host it. In metaphysics, I do not see any place in the universe for a God. Our meager understanding of the universe leaves very little or nothing for God to do other than play the role of a benevolent overlord. I hear that. Someone else mentioned many atheists believe the God story is just like a fairy tale, like Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy, but more flaky because adults actually believe it. It's a pipe dream that some benevolent being is making sure that something good is going to come out of all this misery in the world. I hear that. And I honor those protests because they come out of, and I think, an intelligent engagement with life and with a reflection. I may not agree with it, but I respect where that comes from. Believing in a superpower makes one feel that we have less control over our lives, that we owe our successes to someone other than ourselves. It is scary to think that some calculating superpower could bless our lives with good things because the same superpower could also damn our lives with hardship. You hear the genuineness of where this comes from. And so this is why I'm arguing for us to engage in relationship, because I think it is in relationship, respectful. One can hold firmly one's position, but respectfully engage and speak with others who hold different opinions, strongly as they were. But to find, I believe, the way forward is for us as Christian people to better know and better practice our faith. For in so doing, I hear some people say to me, you know, I have trouble when I hear these things. I don't know what to say. I don't know how to answer. And the invitation is for us to be much more intentional in learning our faith so we have something to say, something to answer. Not definitively, not authoritatively, like I say and it must be, but confessionally out of our experience of God. Powerfully displays to others that we have taken seriously what it means to follow. It's not blind. The last thing that I want to mention, because there's so much that could be said, but I want us to focus now, after having lifted up some various ways in which we can reflect on this and relate to each other, what it is that we share in common. I believe that the challenge for us in the way of Jesus to move forward graciously is to find common ground. And there are some suggestions that I received about common ground. On the telephone, I spoke with someone whom I know I have conversation with, a declared atheist, said, what we can do is find common projects of justice on which to cooperate. Others wrote in the email a concern for others and a desire to improve their conditions, an acceptance that we're fundamentally flawed. Another, if believers accepted their own doubts, they wouldn't be afraid of atheists, and if atheists accepted their own doubts, they wouldn't shun believers. So here's an invitation for humility and for honesty. Here's an invitation to cooperate on those things that mend and bless the world. Whether you call it because it is out of God's purpose or not, at least we can cooperate. And in cooperating, sometimes the decisions about how to deploy that will differ, but in cooperating, what we can do, I believe, is converse and recognize that we have common instincts for the good of the world. That will be a platform for us to share confessionally and graciously the firmness of our beliefs. So my intention today, by saying that we are both seekers and fools, as I've described, because there's sometimes we act in ways that display that we disregard God's involvement, but there are other times when we're earnestly seeking God. In so doing, what I'm inviting us to do, not to answer definitively, but to begin to move in directions of sincerity and intentionality, to learn our faith and to practice it with more urgency and more commitment and enlightenment, because we will see that that has the capacity to do much. Yesterday, and I close with this this reference. Yesterday, along with many others, responded to the invitation of the South African High Commissioner and his wife to attend a celebratory event commemorating Mandela's 91st birthday, which was last week. And this event had a few speakers, but was the airing, the highlighting of a film called Mandela, the exhaustive documentary on his life and chronicled much of his life. And two things from that, I mean, it struck me the commitment, the constancy of the commitment of an imperfect person like me, like everyone, who was committed to seeing justice brought about for all people. And in fact, when he did become president, made clear in his constitution, in the development of the constitution, with the help of Bishop Tutu and others, that all were going to have a fair hearing and all were going to be treated with respect and dignity. What is interesting that came out of this are two things. One is that he spoke of his early childhood. His father, a practicing polygamist, had four wives, and Mandela's mother didn't go very far in school, but was a very wise woman and became a Christian. And early on, Mandela received instruction in the stories of faith, in the working out, as it were, of the principles that Jesus came to demonstrate in his care for the poor and his desire to see an equalizing of access to the bounty of the world. And he has recognized the importance that that has played in his own commitments, in the way he was able to sustain 27 and a half years in prison, and the hope that kept alive as it was interwoven with his political philosophy, etc. And I close with a quote from him, talking about the way of understanding ourselves and how we lean into the world and how we offer ourselves to the world. He wrote, "Our greatest fear is not that we are inadequate, but that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, handsome, talented, and fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We were born to make manifest the glory of God within us. It is not just in some, it is in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our fear, our presence automatically liberates others. We are made to make manifest the glory of God. However varyingly, haltingly understood, let us live our lives and lean into the world with graciousness towards others, those with whom we profoundly disagree, but always making sure that we seek to make manifest the glory of God and to bless the world with who we are. Amen.